Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. The Commonwealth Club is the leading national forum open to all for impartial discussion of public issues. I'm Gerald Harris, chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's program, Becoming Hewlett-Packard and the Key Lessons from Its History of Strategic Leadership. Our moderator today for today's program is Peter Burrows. Peter is a freelance reporter that has covered Silicon Valley since the 1990s. He spent 23 years covering a range of topics for Business Week and then Bloomberg News, including coverage of HP as well as Apple, Cisco, and Microsoft. He is now writing for the MIT Technology Review, among other publications. He may also say some other things about himself. Webb McKinney began his career at HP when David Packard and Bill Hewlett ran the company. McKinney held numerous engineering, management, and executive positions at HP, running HP's entry into the computer, into consumer PCs, and going on to lead its entire PC business. McKinney later led worldwide sales, marketing, and supply chains for all of HP's commercial customers. Before retiring from HP in 2003, McKinney was the EVP responsible for HP's integration with Compaq. McKinney is currently a consultant in mergers and merger integration and leadership development. Lastly, Philip Meza is a strategy consultant and researcher. Much of his consulting work focuses on technology strategy and business development. His books and numerous case studies are used at business schools and universities around the world. Philip is the author of Coming Attractions, Hollywood, High Tech, and Future Entertainment, and co-author of Strategic Dynamics, Concepts, and Cases. Meza also serves on the board of Toolworks, a social enterprise that helps people with disabilities. Without further ado, Peter Burrows and our guests. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's great to be here. I started covering HP in the late 80s when, I think I see a lot of HP faces here, when the company was just universally admired for so many things, business success, corporate citizenship, ethics, the list went on and on. And cut to 15 years later, I wrote a book about the Compaq merger and the Carly Fiorina tenure. And then I stopped covering the company because I thought, this is played out. This story can't get any better. But boy, I was wrong. We've had so much incredible drama, and this company has just been through such a transformation. I thought I knew everything about it. I knew a lot about it, but this book is really terrific, and it's made me really rethink a lot of what I thought I knew about the CEOs. So we've got a lot of history to cover here with coming on 80 years. So let's dive in. I think the first question is, you know, we in the business press are often criticized for taking a great man in history approach to analyzing companies, you know, put too much focus on the CEO. And yet your book, that's exactly what you do. That's the lens you're looking through. So just talk about, you know, why you took that approach and what you learned about the importance of that person in the top.
Okay. Well, you know, that is a strain in history is kind of the great man approach. And, you know, people have said that history is biography. And we don't go that far. But we do think that a key hallmark of HP's longevity has been something that we're calling strategic leadership capability of the CEOs. And strategic leadership capability is a concept that was pioneered by our other author, Robert Bergelman, at Stanford Graduate School of Business. And basically, it's a way of evaluating CEO leadership along a couple of dimensions. And some of the most important dimensions are top-down strategic leadership. So how does the CEO decide where she wants to go and get people to go with her in that direction? Another element is bottom-up strategic leadership. So that is, how well does the CEO really take signals from lower down in the organization, people who are closer to technology change, people who are closer to new markets and new customers, and incorporate that intelligence into the strategy making? Another element of strategic leadership capability is the ability of the CEO to make adjustments and to see what adjustments are needed to the culture to fit the changing environment that the company's in. And another key element I think we're going to discuss a lot of is the ability to work with the board of directors. In a public company, the board of directors is responsible for the governance of the organization. And we're going to see that like Tolstoy's Unhappy Families, for the last 20 years, HP's board has been dysfunctional in its own way. And we'll probably discuss a little bit about that. But strategic leadership capabilities in that respect is the CEO's ability to work with the board he or she has and to shape that board. So we really think that, you know, the strategic leadership capability of the CEO has been what has kept HP alive for more than 80 years or almost 80 years, which is almost unheard of in a technology company. Only IBM has been around and relevant longer than HP. And, you know, I was an English major, but my interpretation of the second law of thermodynamics, you know, everything wants to go to heck after a little while. HP has held together and held relevant for almost 80 years. And that's doing something. That's something that's very unusual. And we think that's a large part of that is due to the strategic leadership capability of the CEOs. So that's why we chose that lens.
Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it'd be useful to just kind of run down the history, talk about each of these CEOs and because as I say, the thing that struck me most about the book is how it got me to reconsider each of the CEOs, not based on the success of the company that they were able to, you know, the stock value, but how they did with the cards that they were dealt. Right. And it came up with some very different kinds of findings. But let's start with Bill and Dave. Obviously, so much has been written about them. Any new insights about what made them so special?
Well, I don't know if they're really new insights, but I think when you look back at what they accomplished, it's pretty incredible. So I think what I'll do here is just give a brief overview. Not everybody in the audience looks like they've spent their lives at HP, so I apologize to the HP people for this. But, you know, Bill and Dave started this company in 1939 out of a garage. They ran it until 1978. So they traded off being CEO and who was the chairman and these things, but they basically ran the company continuously for all that time. By the time they left, HP was about over $1 billion in revenue, was the unquestioned leader in all types of instrumentation, test and measurement, scientific calculation, automated measurement systems, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, but in some ways, partly by accident, become a major player, or not a major player, but a significant player in computers. And so by the time they retired in 78, HP, I think, had about 40% of its revenue in the computer business. Part of what I think made them remarkable is just guiding the company through the massive amount of change during this time, you know, from vacuum tubes to transistors to digital electronics to low-cost computation. And one of the key points that I like to look at with Bill and Dave was in the mid-50s. So HP had been successful, was about almost $50 million in revenue. But Hewlett-Packard realized that they couldn't keep running the company like they had been, which was a traditional sort of functional organization, you know, marketing, sales, et cetera, and that they needed it to continue to grow and to innovate. They needed to change the way the company was operating. So they essentially kind of blew the company up in the mid-50s, and they created the division model, which meant that each of the product lines, say voltmeters and oscilloscopes and microwave, would be like a little company in its own right with its own P&L, its own general manager. So they're able to keep the company small while it got bigger because these operating units were pretty independent, although they shared sales forces and IT and various things. They also at that time codified the HP way. So the culture that became known as the HP way was codified in the mid-50s because they realized they no longer could explain how they wanted the company to work by just walking around and talking to everyone. The company went public at that time, which allowed them, obviously, to reap the benefits of the success the company had had, but also allowed them to the employees in general to do that. So they very quickly established a stock purchase program, were very innovative in terms of creating an environment that employees thrived in. They acquired their sales force. So a whole bunch of things happened in this sort of mid-50 time. And if you fast forward then to the 60s, they were a $300 million company that that had grown and succeeded. So I think this ability to adapt to all this change and to keep HP at the forefront was really what distinguished them. They did all the things Philip just talked about. They managed strategy top-down. Through a central HP lab where new businesses, new technologies were developed. They managed strategy bottom up through innovation that was coming out of the divisions that created new businesses and new opportunities. They acquired companies, and some of the companies that they started outside the company were then later brought into the company. So they were very innovative. In fact, when we interviewed unfortunately, the late Tom Perkins, he said that everything he learned, he knew about venture capital, he learned from Bill and Dave. So they were incredibly innovative and ran a very successful company. During their time, the company grew to over $1 billion. When they went public in 57, the stock then split 6 times when they handed the reins over to John Young.
Mm-hmm. Which brought the first real big transformation because of the company's moving into the computer business. So they'd had this model of this decentralized model of all these small companies that all could grow to scale and become very successful in their own right. But I guess when John Young comes in, he's got to figure out how do we get this company into the computer business, which is a very different beast.
Yeah, and I think I'm continuing on with this one, right? Okay. So, and then we'll then we'll give you a rest. So when John Young took over, he was the first CEO not named Hewlett-Packard in 1978. He'd been a longtime leader, one of the first two division managers at HP when that division model was created. Had been, I think, the heir apparent for some time. And when Bill and Dave handed over the reins to John Young, the big issue that HP was facing was the computer business. As I was saying earlier, HP got into the computer business in some sense initially kind of by accident. And what had happened is that with the advent of digital electronics integrated circuits, the instrumentation that HP had been developing became programmable by computers, okay? In the early days, it was all analog, and you twist a knob and write something down in your lab notebook. But by the 60s, there were these opportunities to automate measurement. And so you needed something to manage all that, so you needed computation. And so HP went into the computer business, but Packard was very adamant that the first product, the 2116, not be called a computer. He wanted it called an instrument controller because he didn't want to upset IBM. IBM was buying a lot of instruments from HP, so he didn't want to say, to them, we're going to compete with you. This is just to control instruments. And obviously that changed over time, but I think it gives you a good indication as to how Packard was thinking about things. And this really was a means to an end. Getting in computers was a way to automate instruments. And then at the same time, ICs were allowing what had been mechanical scientific calculators to be replaced by electronic calculators. So again, really focused on HP's core market, selling high-tech products to scientists and engineers. But over time, of course, computers are general purpose. They get used for a lot of things. And then HP introduced a third line of computers. And so by the time John Young took over, over 40% of the revenue was from computers. Way less than 40% of the profit was from computers. HP was number 17, I believe, in computer market share. This was not counting PCs, which were very small at that point in time. And he and Packard really put their heads together for weeks to try to decide, are we going to get out of this or are we going to become leaders in it? Those were the only two options. And after a lot of thought, they decided that HP had to become a leader in computers. And the main reasons were, by the way, that the people who had been buying HP's computers were all the top instrument customers, right? So it would have been very disruptive to pull out of the business. And secondly, the market was going to be too big to ignore. If HP wanted to continue to grow, they had to get into some bigger markets. So Packard sort of shook, I don't know if he shook John's hand, put his arm around him or something, but he said, good luck, this is going to take 25 years, exit stage left for a while. And then John was left with this enormous problem, which is that we had three overlapping lines of incompatible 16-bit mini computers. Our market share was not significant. In checking around, we didn't have a lot of computer science capability. Most of these computers were invented by people who came from the instrument business, who were good engineers but weren't experts in computers. And so he had to do a lot of things to change the trajectory. One was that he hired Joel Birnbaum, who was the head of computer architecture at IBM. Joel was frustrated because IBM never introduced anything new because they didn't need to. So he would invent all this great stuff, and it would just sit there in the lab. So he came over. John basically went to the person who was running HP's central research labs, took a bunch of money away from him, and said, we're going to invest this in computer research. And that's where he put Joel Birnbaum. Joel, it's a little more complicated story, but Joel invented this architecture that became known as HP Precision Architecture, which is the 32-bit RISC architecture, which really was state-of-the-art. But the divisions, this division model, which worked really well for instruments, was a little more of a problem. See, we've got the knowledge here in the front row. A little more of a problem for computers, where this is before there were standards and all the computer parts had to work together, right? You had to have the processor and the operating system and the peripherals and the network. And so we had three different lines of computers. So those division managers didn't want John to tell them what to do because, they had their own P&L and all this. So John had to basically override this division model that had worked so well in instruments and force the divisions to really take this new architecture so HP could converge into one 32-bit architecture, one operating system, HP UX. And that only took 8 years. So John, the first of the new products shipped 8 years after this all started, which was a challenge for the company to go that long without really fundamentally new technology. But ultimately, became very successful. When John retired, HP had grown to number four and was headed to really a tie for number one with IBM and in the server business. The other thing that happened under Young, which was really remarkable, was while John was fighting all these battles to get these new systems invented and out the door, up in Boise, they came up with a product called the LaserJet. And so HP, and since they were in Boise and a long way from Palo Alto, they kind of did what they wanted, And so they started selling these LaserJets to work on IBM PCs, not on HPs. HP, of course, had its own interface. It didn't work with anyone else at the time. And so a lot of the leaders in HP wanted to kill that business. They thought it was not an appropriate business. It didn't have enough value add because the guts came from Canon. And they shouldn't be selling these PCs on other people's computers. And Young just looked at him and said, you don't sell enough computers for them to care about you. That's your problem. And then Packard also supported Young in this and said, you need to keep doing this. And so coming out of the Young era, HP was becoming very well positioned in computers, still the clear leader in instrumentation, and also had created a really fast-growing and profitable printer business and great returns to shareholders. The only problem was in 1990, somehow Dave Packard and Young had a falling out. And Packard was upset. I don't know. I don't think John even knows all the reasons, but one of them was that Young had created a lot of bureaucracy in getting these new computer systems out, probably too much, okay, for anyone who's working there, where there's just a lot of committees and to get everything converged. And a lot of people weren't happy with that, including a lot of the top managers who worked at HP and liked that more independent division model. Another was, in taking 8 years to get the new systems out, that wasn't the best thing for our financial returns during that time. So the stock, it was languishing a little bit, although it performed very well under Young. And so Packard got involved in 1990, and he forced Young to reorganize the company into three businesses: test and measurement, computer systems, and computer products. And computer products were the fledgling PC business and printing. And the thing I think that's interesting about that is that those three businesses all became separate companies over time. Over the next 25 years, those all became separate companies. So Packard wasn't totally wrong. So
yeah, I thought it was really interesting that Packard got so upset that he even wrote a thinly veiled a column in the San Jose Mercury.
He did, which is it was surprising because, you know, there was a strong value about treating people with respect, but obviously Dave was not happy at that point. But but anyhow, at the end of it, when John Young handed over to Lou Platt, HP had grown from a little over $1 billion to $16 billion. And very profitable. The stock had performed very well. So he did a great job in very, very difficult circumstances.
Yeah. And so I started covering the company soon after Platt took over. And, you know, at that time, HP had a reputation. I was told, you'll never get a cover story on HP. it's just too boring and steady. And it never happens. And then Lou Platt, the company goes crazy. The growth goes through the roof. And for a few years, and he ends up on the cover of Business Week, sitting on top of a big pile of, PCs. Mm-hmm. So that's what I thought of the Lou Platt era. You guys had a very, very interesting take on that era and his stewardship.
Yeah, the Platt era is really, it's rich and it's poignant. It's to really understand the Platt era, we have to kind of revisit for a moment the John Young era. And you mentioned the article in the San Jose Mercury News, that thinly veiled article that Dave wrote. In HP executives are great. They almost always keep their own archives. And one of the engineers who was very helpful in our interviews is a guy named, he died about a year and a half ago, named Court Rensselaer. And he had, in his home in Los Altos, he had an entire room dedicated to his personal archives. And he said, go for it. And I bought him a sandwich, and that was his condition. I took him to lunch, bought him a sandwich, and he gave me access to his archives, which are now at Stanford, by the way. I made sure they ended up at Stanford, and his family donated into the school. And digging through his archives, I find this just really sad memo from Dave Packard to the two other top executives at HP, carbon copying John Young, basically just denigrating John's leadership. And that is so antithetical to everything that Bill and Dave had done up to that point. And so I think that really shows how much trust John had lost with Dave, and from my perspective, unreasonably. The relationship between Packard and Young was fairly poisoned by that time. And so when Lou Platt was selected to lead the company, he was really surprised because he thought the guy from Boise, Hackborn, was going to get the job. And apparently Hackborn was like Caesar. He was offered it twice and he turned it down twice. And so they go to Lou Platt, who was the next obvious candidate to do it. By the way, kind of an important thing to mention is the fact that they had a deep bench of executives that they could go to. It didn't occur to them to go look outside HP for the next generation of leadership. So they tap Lou Platt, and Dave tells Lou, and we got this from Lou Platt's widow. Lou Platt's no longer with us, and we interviewed all the living CEOs, and we were able to interview Lou Platt's widow. And she told us that Dave tells Platt, no uncertain terms, your number one job is to restore the HP way, which Dave thought had been corrupted under Young's leadership, particularly with getting to the computers. So the centralizing of power that was necessary to get the computer systems out and other activities that that John Young had to do to make HP as successful as it was under his leadership. So Lou Platt becomes CEO in 1992. All of the big investments that HP made in HP, that big computer system that Webb had described, had been made. And now the profits are rolling in. And so Lou Platt comes, and basically the money truck is backing up into HP's parking lot. Imaging and printers is taking off. And as you guys may know, that's just hugely successful. I mean, we probably all in here use HP Inc., and that's just like opening up your wallet to HP. It's just pure profit for HP. In fact, later on, it's going to account for more than 100% of HP's profits, which means everything else was losing money except for Inc. And so the money truck's backing up. Platt's getting on the cover of, you know, journalists are writing again about HP. But Platt had many, many, many great qualities. Yesterday was Women's Day, right? And Platt, back in the early 90s, made a priority to get more women in technology. And it's particularly more women in technology at HP. He would realize that by having two or three of the top senior executives during his tenure were women and were longtime executives at HP. But bless him, Platt did not think his job as a CEO was to formulate strategy and to lead strategy at HP. He thought that his job was to be hands-off and to delegate strategy to what he was going to elevate into his group presidents. And for a long time, that the problems don't show because of all the profits coming. And so Platt can be hands-off all he wants. The group presidents are doing what they're doing. And the fact that they're really not acting in any coordinated fashion isn't becoming clear yet because of all the money that's coming in from Inc. and all the money that's coming in from HP PA, that computer system Webb described. But while this is going on, there are a couple of external forces that are happening. So HP can't afford to manufacture microprocessors anymore. It's manufacturing microprocessors is a huge – designing and manufacturing is a hugely expensive undertaking. So back then, a plant to build a microprocessor cost $1 billion. This is back in the 90s. It's $3.5-4 billion now. And by the way, Intel owns it because they've got the scale, right? So you're never going to be able to compete against Intel on this. So Platt makes the decision that the decision's pretty much made for Platt that by the economics of the industry that HP can't really compete in microprocessor design, which means you really can't be designing computer systems anymore like they did the system Webb described. So they make a bet on the Intel Windows Intel combination, which will become clear later on, sucks all the profit out of the industry, basically sends all the profit in the industry to Intel and to Microsoft and nothing for HP. This isn't clear at that time, but this is going on. Meanwhile, the stock market is really slow to recognize this. The stock split 2-for-1 in 1995, 2-for-1 again in 1996. That's going to turn out to be the high watermark, though, of HP. And Platt, again, even though he was very hands-off, thinks, you know, we're a $40 billion company. How can I keep this train running? And there was some research coming out at that time that said companies plateau. They hit stall points at around $40 billion. So at that time, 1996, $40 billion would be like $60 billion today. And Platt says, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I can keep this growing. I probably can't keep this growing. So he undertakes, which was really hugely bold at the time, that they called Project Giraffe to break up the company. And Platt just realizes he cannot run HP and he cannot get the growth that he thinks he needs to get with HP configured the way it is. So he goes and does some research with some consultants and he goes to his board and he says, we need to break up this company and we need to break it up into four pieces. And this brings up the story of the board. So under Bill and Dave had what we call a founder's board, which is known as a founder's board. Now, so basically that's friends, your friends. Now, Bill and Dave, their friends are pretty distinguished, right? They have Nobel laureates. They have, you know, very distinguished people on the board. But their job is to do what Bill and Dave, is to rubber stamp Bill and Dave. And while Bill and Dave's running the show, they're making pretty good decisions. By the time that Platt's thinking of breaking up the company, Dave is dead. Bill is out of the picture really. And their family members are on the board. And so you have half of the board is friends of Bill and Dave and the other half are their children of Bill and Dave who are again, themselves very distinguished as you might imagine children of Bill and Dave to be, but they're not really involved in the company and their orientation, their outlook is to preserve the legacy of their fathers. So they're faced with this fundamental decision that would be hard for anyone to undertake, which is should we break up the company? Well, HP, much like Lou was worried about, HP's results fall off a cliff after 1996. So 1997, down year, 1998, a worse year. And this really turns up the heat on breaking up the company. And so the board, which was half founders board, half family board, decides, well, you know, Lou, okay, you can split off the test and measurement because that's the business, and this is really the family driving this decision. You can split off test and measurement because that's what we care about. That's our father's legacy. We want to make sure that stays intact. We'll keep everything else together, and you're not needed. So thank you very much. Sure. And they start to look outside for leadership, which brings up your friend.
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, you know, I mean, it was shocking at the time. I mean, nobody knew her name. I mean, out here, obviously, she was Carly Fiorina was a very successful salesperson of telecommunications equipment for Lucent, but nobody really saw it coming, and it was a very interesting choice. You know, she's taken a lot of heat over the years, including from people like me, trying to do a very complex reorganization of the company. I'm trying to move us along because I see the clock going. And ultimately, that doesn't work out so well, the compact deal. She doubles down on this lower commodity, less profitable products, the compact PCs. It was very easy. Walter Hewlett opposed that deal. A lot of people opposed the deal because they wanted the old HP back, you know. This is everything that HP isn't. This is scale over profits. You know, now that we're looking backwards, what do you make of this decision she made, and why didn't it work out?
Well, I think, I think just a couple of quick points. One is that during this time when Luplau was struggling with HP's growth, which had really slowed down, the first internet bubble happened. Right. And HP kind of missed that. And I think it was in part a result of having, you know, four strategies instead of one, and a lack of overall focus from the top on something that was that transformative to the industry. So when Platt went into the board, he was actually recommending splitting up test and measurement, computer systems, right, which is now called Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, and then the computer products, PCs and printers, either split them off separately or together was kind of his recommendation, which I think looking back now happened, right? So maybe it wasn't such a crazy idea, but the board, as Philip said, wouldn't do that. So when Fiorina arrived, well, first of all, the interesting thing is the board had decided there were several good people working for Lou Platt at the time who probably would have been reasonable candidates to be the CEO, at least a couple. But the board had decided not only did they not want Platt, but that they did not want an insider, that they wanted to go outside. And I think their motivation was in part, one of the things that happens with a multi-business company like HP was, is that if you don't proactively manage succession, so if you don't take people and move them around so they work in all the major businesses, then when you're looking for the next CEO, you're saying, well, that person's only been in printers and that person's only been in PCs. They don't know all this. So I think that was one of the factors. And another was at the time there were these very brash public, there was Bill Gates and Scott McNeely, and there was all this flash out there. And I think the board was saying, we need some of that. We need to get a little more exciting, you know. And Carly is as we probably all know who she is because she's been in politics, but she's a very poised, very polished kind of a person. And so the board hired Fiorina. She made it very clear from the beginning that she was in charge of strategy, which, you know, again, as Philip said, Platt tried to run HP in a little more of a GE kind of a model where you had the appliance division and the jet engine division and the mortgage division and so on. She made it clear that strategy was her job, that she was going to do that. In the interest of time, I won't go through all the things that happened. But what happened is, and you may recall this, that her first attempt was to buy Price Waterhouse's high-end consulting business. And that became very public and sort of fell apart. And then not too long after that, a few months later, it was announced that HP was going to buy Compaq. And I think to a lot of people, those look like two very different types of acquisitions, right? One is kind of compete with IBM in services, and the other is go volume and commodity, more commodity business. I think at that point, employees were a bit confused, and I think the analyst community and the outside world was always confused from then on about what that really was a strategy if you would consider two things that were that different. But I think what Fiorina believed was that the industry was consolidating, which has turned out to be true, that we needed to get the volume in these businesses in order to lead and get a competitive price structure. So she really felt that it was critical for HP to get this additional scale. Also, we had bet on Intel for our server technology, and Compaq was a leader in Intel server, Intel-based servers, and HP was not. So and it was fairly complementary, although it was huge, in that every place HP was strong, Compaq was weak, and vice versa. So the idea was let's eliminate the stuff that isn't strong. Let's get more focus on the areas where we are strong and put it all together. I think what happened under Fiorina was that they were never really fully able to execute that strategy, right? So what happened is, even though the merger goals were met, the company started missing their financial projections. And I can't remember how many. You remember data better than I do, Phil. But I think we missed
eight or nine
quarters, where we said, here's what you'd expect from us next quarter, we'd miss it. And ultimately, the board, which by now had been reconstituted, the family members were gone. It was half what had been the Compaq board. Perkins came back to the company because he'd been on the Compaq board. And it was a very different kind of a board. They were very supportive of Carly in the beginning, but ultimately got frustrated because the stock was not performing well. And when you miss your numbers like that, and they put pressure on her to hire a COO. So they really weren't saying, Carly, you have to go. They said, you have to get a COO to help you manage this, because clearly we're not able to hit our numbers. And she refused. And so then we go to another chapter. By the way, in spite of the fact that HP was struggling and at the end of the plat era, I think the stock hit an all-time high in 1999, ironically, 65, which was when Lou was fired. And when Fiorina left, it was just over $20.
There's one question about strategy by Fiorina, because, you know, those years was when the smartphone and the cloud and all of these huge trends that have really driven the industry since were starting to emerge, and HP didn't show up. How did that happen?
Well, I think the by the way, I think that HP clearly missed this transition to smartphones to handheld computing, really. There's a general answer and a more specific one. The general one is that, interestingly enough, so did Intel, and so did Microsoft, and so did Dell. And the mainframe companies missed the mini computer business, and the mini computer companies missed the PC business. So there's something about standing on the top of a mountain where you can't then see the next mountain range forming, I think. But I think in this case specifically, there was another issue, and that was that we were selling a lot of computer systems to telecom companies at the time. And Fiorina, much like Packard had been worried about calling the first computer a computer, Fiorina was very worried about HP entering the, quote, phone business. Now, it didn't really turn into, I mean, we do use our phones, but I don't know about you. I use my iPhone for a lot more than my phone, right? So I think what happened is she really, there was quite an internal battle going on about this, and the people who were running the mobile business, the notebook business, definitely wanted to go in the smartphone business, and Carly didn't let them do that because she didn't want to offend our telco customers on the server side, which, by the way, obviously not a good decision, but also it points out the problems of running a business that has multiple businesses that oftentimes have conflicting interests.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the clock, and we're going to run out of time. So I think I'm going to, rather than keep going on each CEO, give us your thoughts on, so who was the best, let's put Bill and Dave aside, of the others, which was the most effective CEO for HP, and who was the least?
Well, I think we agree on the most effective.
We do.
Yeah, John Young, right?
John Young, right.
Yeah, for the reasons I think that you explained. So I'm going to go out. I like to be quantitatively driven as much as possible. And so what I'm going to say now about the least effective CEO is going to go in the face of the numbers, right? So Mark Hurd, whom I have a lot of respect for, he managed to, during his tenure at HP, he returned 16% annualized return. The NASDAQ returned what, do you guys think? 3%. So you think that, well, that's a hugely successful tenure. But when you peel that onion, You see that he furthered Fiorina's strategy, which was a problem. He further eroded a lot of the M&A decisions he made, destroyed value and eroded the culture further. And then he cut R&D because he was a master of making his numbers, which is why those stock returns were so good, because he didn't miss his projections. He hit his projections. He exceeded his projections. He knew how to work the numbers, and he worked the numbers by cutting costs. Some of the costs he cut were R&D, which further warped HP from being a company that really made a contribution, a technological contribution, to just kind of being a scale and scope mass producer. So for all his success and all his talents as a CEO, I would say he was the least effective for the reasons I just described. Hmm. Would you agree with?
I would agree, but I would also say that if you look at the early part of Mark Hurd's time, right, he inherited the Fiorina strategy not well executed. I would say for the first two or three years, what he did was exactly what needed to be done. He got the organization humming. He executed, and he actually achieved the goals that Fiorina had set for the in acquiring Compaq. One goal was to be the largest technology company. And that was a key goal she was driving toward. One can debate whether that's the right goal or the wrong goal, but that was the goal. And under Hurd, they achieved that. They became number one in PCs, number one in servers, a number one technology company. I think HP peaked a little after Mark's time at $127 billion. So I think he was very effective in the beginning. I think the second half of the Hurd era is a very different story. He just kept cutting costs, acquiring. He acquired EDS. He acquired Palm. 3Com, many of those acquisitions really didn't work out. And so I think even though Wall Street loved him, I think a lot of damage was done in the second half of his time at HP.
Yeah, I think people started to think that the HP way was sort of a historical term at that point, you know, that it just doesn't really exist anymore.
Well, when he comes in and half the employees didn't come from HP, that's Compaq, mm-hmm. right? Then you buy EDS, it literally has hundreds of thousands of employees. And then Mark himself didn't seem to really be a big fan of the HP way. In fact, the longtime managers there referred to his approach as ethnic cleansing. You know, he brought in so many high mid-level executives who were not from HP because he didn't seem comfortable with that more collaborative mm-hmm. approach, I think.
So what about the HP way now? So it was interesting. I was just crunching the numbers. The four companies that have come out of HP, HP Inc., HP Enterprises, Agilent, and Keysight.
Yeah.
Their stocks are up a combined 38% in the last year. That's better than Apple. That's better than a whole lot of people, obviously off of a low base. But still, it makes me, I'm curious, what do you think of the HP way now? Is it alive and well? Does it exist in any of those four companies?
Yeah, I think, by the way, and I don't have I can't prove this, but I've had people tell me that Agilent actually generated more shareholder value after it spun out from HP than HP did. And it's probably true, because not only did Agilent do well themselves, but they sold off businesses and in order to focus and got great shareholder return from those deals as well. So, but I think back to your question, I'm not working in any of those companies, so this is just my educated guess. I would think that the three of those four companies probably have cultures that would be very recognizable as HP cultures. And the HP culture, by the way, always changed. The culture can't be static. And so, it was something that was consciously moving as the business required through the years. But I would think Keysight, which is the original electronic measurement business, is probably very similar. I would think Agilent. In fact, I know from talking to the leaders at Agilent, when they spun off from HP, they wanted to keep most of the culture, and they wanted to change a couple of things, like be a lot faster, I know was one of them. I think I've done some work with HP Inc., and I think it's actually surprisingly HP-like. You know, the printer business is all HP people, right? Most of the leadership is longtime HP people, and actually a good portion of the The PC business has a lot of HP people in it, too. And when they launched that company, I happened to be there, they had put a big focus on restoring the HP way, restoring innovation. I think the wild card is Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, and I say that because it's the product of so many acquisitions and so many spinoffs now that I really would be surprised. I don't know what the culture of that organization is, but I suspect it's not as HP-like as the rest.
Mm-hmm. And in a bigger sense, you know, Bill and Dave's DNA really is in the Valley now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so much of what we think of as Silicon Valley ethos were really Bill and Dave's ethos. So, you know, the HP way lives on, waxes and wanes at different at the children, the progeny of HP itself, but it lives in the Valley.
I thought we'd spend a little bit of time just talking about what other companies can learn from the HP experience. You know, one of the really interesting things, you know, clearly when Lou Platt tried to break the company up and was not allowed to, that was a major moment for the company. So begs the question a little bit, what about these gigantic companies that are of a scale that Bill and Dave could never have imagined? Should they be thinking of, you know, when's the right time to start thinking about breaking up instead of continuing to grow?
Well, you know, I think one thing is that HP, by the time that Platt was recommending breaking the company up, it was a very much a multi-business company. Right. So you had test and measurement, you had the computer systems, computer products, even within there, you had multiple businesses. So I think that's when you can start thinking about, is this really better together or is it better to have a smaller, more focused company? I think if your company is kind of in one business, I don't know how you think about splitting it up. So to some extent, I mean, HP, after all, for the first 30 years was a test and measurement company, right? But by the 90s, it was very much a multi-business company where each of these businesses was large and could stand on its own. I think the other comment I'd make is if you get in that situation where you really have a balanced portfolio, be careful with what you think is leverage, because leverage always looks good on paper. Sometimes it can be very, very hard to operationalize. And you know, when Whitman decided to split the company in 2015, I think there were a couple of reasons that she's been public with. One is she was unable to actually achieve the cost structure that had been predicted. In other words, she couldn't really get the lowest cost structure because the company was so complicated, right? Mm-hmm. And the second was that it was a problem with focus. Is that she would go from a meeting on printers to a meeting on PCs to a meeting on the cloud to a meeting on this to a meeting on that. So as the CEO, if you think of it, she was competing with, you know, Lexmark and Dell and IBM and all this sort of thing. So I think there's an issue of the value of focus and speed. So if you try to leverage, you create complexity and you get slower. So I think those are some of the things that really need to be considered.
Okay. I'm getting the high sign that it's time for Q&A.
We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We would now like to open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short. You may line up behind the mic and go one at a time. We have about 15 minutes for questions. And I will start with one. Okay. During the mid-90s, I think during the John Young era, I was at a consulting firm called Global Business Network, and we did scenario analysis. And I remember some of our executives came down and worked with HP on the evolution of the industry. Do any of you recall that? And was this sort of approach of having multiple views of the future when you're making all these tough decisions, was it helpful to think that way, or were things just so locked up politically that you couldn't really think outside the box?
Well, I think having been there, I mean, I think the issue with HP is that there were so many different businesses and so many different business leaders, and they were all thinking outside of the box. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, like, I remember we did a lot of work with Institute for the Future, for example, on scenario planning. I think the issue got to be more with digesting all that and figuring out what the company should do overall. right, and what the overall strategy of the company should be. But I think the company, certainly up through that period, was pretty externally focused and looking at. In fact, I remember, if I could, in the early 90s, Joel Birnbaum, who'd been hired by Young to develop this computer architecture, after he was finished with that, he went off and they asked him to think about what's the future of the computer industry going to look like. And he came back, and this is the early 90s now, and I remember this very well. He said, in the future, information technology will be delivered as a service. Okay, the word cloud hadn't been created yet. The internet will be pervasive and everything will be connected. So Internet of Things, mobility. So it wasn't that HP didn't have people who knew where things were going. They struggled with how to get there, I think, at that point.
So I've read the book. And
oh, you're the one.
I think you were very kind to the board.
Really?
Yes. Not so much in the later times when it was public, very public dysfunction was out there, but earlier on. And I wonder, you know, had the board lent on Dave when he refused to hand the reins to John Young and said, wait a minute, you know, this is the guy that's basically got us into the computer business. He's the best we've got. He's recognized throughout the industry as an enormous talent. You should shut up and let him run it. Things might have turned out very differently. And I think, I guess my question is whether in looking at all this, obviously your focus has been on the CEO, but just in general, do you see a lesson in board engagement with maybe some things that the CEO should be in charge of, like strategy and this is succession planning, that should be a lesson for other
companies? I'll let Philip answer that, but let me just say I wanted the book to be called Bored to Death, so I'm sorry we're so nice.
We would have sold more if we had been there. You know, so boards are very opaque, right? And our view into the board is because we had real live board members who were talking to us. And if you start talking about the board circa 1980, 1990, it's harder to find them. I think in response to your scenario that it would have been nice if someone had challenged Dave, yes, that would have been the right thing to do. But that would be like, that would be akin to telling Jeff Bezos, no, you know, Amazon Web Service, not so much. You shouldn't be doing that. You just can't. Now, Bezos has the votes. Bill and Dave still had a lot of shares then, but they didn't, you know, they didn't have that many shares. So you're talking about moral authority of the founder, and it would be almost impossible, to my mind, for someone to have, especially with the founders board that they had formed, to second guess Packard, especially Packard. But you raise a bigger question, which is, you know, what's the proper role of the board? And the proper role of the board absolutely has to be to provide governance, and it's going to be an enlightened founder who actually has a board that she or he that will challenge him or her. And if you look at the boards today of some of the leading companies that are still founder run, you get a little more sanguine. You're a little bit happier. I mean, I think Amazon's board looks pretty good. I think Apple's board looks pretty good. Google's board looks pretty good. Now, I understand Google's still, you know, it's the founder show, but you know, they've got a board that at least from where I sit, looks like they would give some real proper guidance to the founders.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to this too is that one of the things I find surprising is that Bill and Dave obviously did not see the board as important to the long-term success of the company. They couldn't have, right? Mm-hmm. And that's probably the biggest mistake they ever made.
Yeah.
Hey, so you talk about the importance of culture and reference the HP way a number of times, but was hoping you could back up just a little bit and define what you mean by the HP way, perhaps with a couple examples of how that's generalizable to other organizations, both big and small.
Well, yeah. Do you want me to?
No, get started.
Yeah, there was, and we talk about the HP way, which is what the culture became known as. The reality is there was a document that was called the Corporate Objectives, I believe, and it had several bullet points. So one would be profit. Profit was the number one objective. But critically, profit was the result of building great products that did the best job of meeting customers' needs. So it didn't come from cost cutting. It was long-term. Long-term sustainable profitability came from making a contribution. And I can't tell you how many times I would show a leader of HP a new product, and they'd just look at me and say, what's the contribution? I go, oh, well, it's a little smaller. You know, but so that was one. So growth, not growth for growth. So growth was a thing that happened if you built great products. Profit was a thing that would happen if you built great products, self-finance growth, integrity in all things, absolute integrity in all things. Okay, if you, I mean, bad things happen when people are involved, but if nobody was allowed to do anything that was unethical, that was the end of their career at HP. Treating people with respect and creating an environment where they can innovate and create. I was reading Amazon's recent annual report, and Jeff Bezos said that innovation and failure are inseparable twins. I love that statement. Because if you create an environment where you can't fail, you'll eliminate innovation, which I think, unfortunately, has happened in some parts of HP over the last few years. So I think they understood that. Create a great environment. Make it safe to fail. Encourage people to take risks. Giving back to the community is very important. HP has always believed in giving back to the communities where we do business. And Bill and Dave themselves served on nonprofit boards while they were running the company. They walked the talk. There was some guidance about fields of interest. How do you decide about new areas that you might go into? So there's a series of 7 or 8 bullet points that define what became known as the HP way. And I think I look at Amazon, by the way. They have they're different principles, but they're taking a similar approach. They have a handful of key principles that everyone understands and believes in. And they have an approach to delegating. Bill and Dave sort of came up with a structural solution to that with divisions, which ultimately wasn't as robust as probably it could have been. Amazon has an approach to what decisions do Bezos and his staff need to make. And Jeff describes it as if you go through this door and can't get back, I need to make the decision. So they're various, but they have at least a conceptual way to think about how decisions get made and what types of decisions are made at what levels. So those are examples.
You know, Susan Bowick, who is a longtime HR executive at HP, said, you know, culture is the way things get done. And that's what your culture is. And the way things get done really reflect the kind of organization, and the organization is going to reflect the pressures that are put on it. So I'm thinking specifically of Mark Hurd. When he took over the job, he had a bunch of mutual fund managers come, basically large investors, and just dump on him for fearing of missing all those numbers. And the ownership of HP had really changed from Hurd to Leo Apotheker, who we didn't bring up. He had an 11-month tenure as CEO. That's more the board's fault than his. By the time Apotheker became CEO, the ownership, according to him, of HP had really changed and had become a value stock, which means that people are coming, trading in and out of your stock on a monthly basis. So no one's holding your HP stock. And so that pressure, they're putting pressure on the CEO, who in turn could either reflect that pressure back or magnify it on the organization. And those two org leaders did the latter. And that shapes your culture as well.
If we can trace back to when HP was a small to medium-sized company and was growing very fast, I'm curious what type of systems management put in place to encourage both organic growth but at the same time control it so that quality was not compromised.
I can start. You know, so that was pretty much the division model, right?
Yeah.
So that was something that was instilled in HP in 1957 when they were still quite small, but they just IPO'd and they had had, you know, 17 years of profitable growth from World War II on. And so they put together a division model, and that works well for them until, you know, the 80s. And so what systems do you think they put in after
Well,
that?
I think, first of all, the divisions, which is where the products were brought to market, they weren't measured only on profit. They were measured on, you had to, you know, do customer satisfaction surveys, channel satisfaction surveys, employee satisfaction surveys. So there was a whole dashboard, if you will, of how divisions and division management was judged. And it was a very balanced, what I guess what today would be called a balanced scorecard approach. The other thing was that Packard and Hewlett, I think in part because they were children of the Depression, did not want debt. And so growth was self-financed, right? So HP, you know, HP's average growth rate for the first many decades was about 15% a year. It never really grew rapidly by today's standards. And so it was a very, even though you compound that, and obviously you get to be very big over time, It was always a, you know, there were a couple of years where the growth was high, particularly this time when Young came out with this new set of computers, and that was growing really fast for 3 or 4 years. It actually was hard to manage in terms of training management, maintaining quality, all the things you talked about. But for the most part, HP was a very moderate growth environment.
And there was also a lot of real discipline about what businesses they were going to get into.
Absolutely.
You know, Steve Jobs is famous for saying, you know, the most important decisions I make are the ones when we say no. Mm-hmm. And that's the sense I always had about HP,
yeah,
including the Mac, come to think of it, because Apple, you know, Steve Wozniak first went to HP and pitched, tried to get HP to build the Mac. Or not the Mac, excuse me, the Apple One.
The Apple, yeah, mm-hmm. Apple yeah. One or two, yeah. Yeah, in fact, Young, when we interviewed Young, I said, John, I always got the feeling that you were not very enthusiastic about the PC business, because it's really Platt who pushed down the accelerator on the PC business. Young was very, they viewed it more as just a smart terminal for the computers. He said, I wasn't. He said, I was very worried about what would happen if we were successful in that business. I thought that was a very interesting comment.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of Northern California. Now for our last question.
There's been quite a bit of talk about the culture. You've just described the HP way, and there's been a discussion about Carly's tenure and not executing and having multiple quarters of not hitting the numbers. I'm curious, from your perspective, how much of the clash of cultures between the compact culture and the HP culture was to blame or contributed to the fact that HP was not able to, or Carly wasn't able to execute the strategy in that period?
I don't think that was a major factor. I mean, there was a clash of, I mean, there were three cultures at that point. There was HP, there was Compaq, and there was Carly. And you know, because Carly, after all, had come from Lucent, she had a different way of operating. And if you look inside Compaq, you'd find Digital and Tandem. So there were a lot of cultures at play all of a sudden. But I actually don't think that was the driving force. I think it was an inability to set realistic goals and to stay focused on the details to execute those goals.
Please join me in thanking our speakers this evening.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
We'd like to thank our listening audience as well, and this program of the Commonwealth Club is closed.